documenting the crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
And all the rest of the nation is still sleeping. They'll be bidding America goodbye.
I'm just south of the Great Lakes capital city, enjoying the lead-free life and broadcasting live from FEMA Region 5 and the ice-filled swamplands of reinvented Michigan. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks, your host here for the next 3 hours. Nice to have you with us as we once again document the crisis of our republic, the undermining of our national, state, and individual autonomy. Today is the 23rd of January, 2016, and it's good to have you with us once again. Kind of surprising to see the lead... in the drinking water story from Flint, making such a prominent national news this past week. It's incredible how this whole thing has blown up. What started off as a local story, and which is one of the reasons why I haven't really talked about it here, but now it's gone national as the governor here in the state, Governor Rick Snyder, has went to the federal government and sought assistance, financial assistance, to help bail Flint out. And so, you know, ladies and gentlemen, none of this stuff would be happening if it weren't for the fact that the governor did not listen to the people of the state of Michigan. This is another reason why this guy should never be anywhere near the White House. You know, there was talk, and I don't hear the talk anymore, but there was talk that he might run for president at some point in the future. And but I remember, you know, this decision was made by the emergency financial manager. They tried to pass it off on the locals. The fact is, it was the emergency financial manager. The locals never made the decision to switch the source of the drinking water in Flint prior to the EFM being involved. And back, I should back up a little bit. That law here in Michigan, the one that enabled the emergency financial manager, was voted down by the people. That law, which gave the governor executive power to take over cities and overthrow elections, was voted down. It was put on a referendum here in the state. The people said no, and Rick Snyder went ahead and did it anyway. What he did is when the referendum went through and it didn't go the way he wanted, there were two versions of the law. Originally, the legislature passed the law, and he signed it into law, and then they modified the law. So when the people voted against the law, Rick Snyder said, oh, well, we'll just reinstate the original law. So the guy's already acting like a dictator, and he had just got in office. But none of this with the water would be happening if it weren't for him not listening to the will of the people, because there wouldn't have been an EFM in the city of Flint to make the decision to switch the source of the drinking water, which has poisoned all these people. And some people are saying the story's overblown, but it's not overblown by the people that are actually affected by it. There are evidently parts of Flint that are unaffected from what I'm hearing. But this is just another nasty situation of what happens when a government doesn't listen to the will of the people. Anyway, enough about that, because I still think it's predominantly a local issue, but certainly it's got a lot of national play on it. We have a situation developing, ladies and gentlemen, across this country. We've been really talking about it here for years. The situation with the increasing military presence, increasing martial law type activity taking place. And I think this is something that everybody needs to be concerned about and being paying attention to. Truth Out did a story, about a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks ago. It was actually January 11th. There are military drills taking place in Washington State right now, which look an awful lot to me like Jade Helm 2.0. The story that they broke was called Navy Uses U.S. Citizens as Pawns in Domestic War Games. I want to share this with you because I think this is very important, especially in light of the fact that they did not tell, they're not telling people, they're not going through the proper channels to get permission to do this sort of thing. We have military bases in this country for the military to be drilling. Why do they need to do all this secret stuff, ladies and gentlemen? It's just like the Jade Helm 15 drills was you know, the subtitle, it was called Mastering the Human Domain, where these people were, these military men were to be involved with the locals. And the whole thing had the smack of an intelligence gathering operation on the general population. And I look at this as being very much similar to the same way. I think that what's going on here, ladies and gentlemen, is a desensitization process where you folks are getting used to, they're getting you used to seeing military in the skies, on the streets, everywhere you go. Why? Why would this be necessary? Unless it's a psychological operation. Dar Jamal writes that beginning in mid-January, Navy SEALs will be practicing unannounced and clandestine combat beach landings across Washington State's Puget Sound and many other coastal areas of that state. The simulated combat exercises, which will include the use of mini submarines and other landing craft, will deposit Navy SEALs carrying simulated weapons on 68 beach and state park areas in Puget Sound. The Strait de Juan de Fuca and Washington's West Coast, unbeknownst to most of the relevant government agencies tasked with overseeing these areas. Internal Navy emails, two slideshows, and other documents obtained exclusively by Truthout reveal the vast extent of the operations. They also reveal the fact that the Navy labeled the relevant files for official use only and emails as attorney-client privilege, a move that exempts such documents from the Freedom of Information Act. In the new scenario, which the military calls realistic military training, Navy SEALs carrying simulated weapons may also travel across public and private property, listeners. Public and private property. Through public and private marinas, occupied by people living on boats. They could conduct war game patrols on roads through residential communities. In addition to tribal, state, federal, and county lands, there are many properties on the Navy's list of training sites marked as private. Naval plans include the use of special reconnaissance teams, conducting patrols which are authorized to go on simulated direct action missions. The definition of direct action is short duration strikes and other small scale offensive actions conducted as an operation, a special operation, in hostile, denied, or politically sensitive environments, and which employ specialized military capabilities to seize, destroy, capture, exploit, recover, or damage designated targets. Public concern for what is clearly an ongoing domestic military expansionism is growing, they say. Despite some strange conspiracy theories around Operation Jade Helm in 2015, the operation also provoked a very real concern: the spread of the military into residential and public areas. This, coupled with several recently documented instances of abusive, unlawful behavior by Navy SEALs overseas, has many people alarmed by what is to come. Across Washington, the Navy's upcoming war game exercises, which are slated to begin January 14th, so I'm presuming that they already are underway, they will be carried out across 68 beach areas around the state, many of which lie within the boundaries of state parks. Now, listeners, I just learned of this a short time ago. So this thing is evidently very secret, not getting a whole lot of media attention. I looked to try to find media attention it's getting. There's a couple of local papers that finally did pick up the story, but I'm not seeing a whole lot of widespread anything, except in the alternative media. And even that is sparse. So my question is, how many of these other military-type exercises are going on in other places that we don't even know about? How many operations does the military have going on in domestic territory, listeners? They say many of these beaches are popular with the public and contain campgrounds and marinas. According to maps in the two slideshows, Truthout obtained, Navy SEAL activities will occur well inland from the beaches. Each site for these exercises will be utilized 2 to 8 times per year, and events can last between 2 and 72 hours. Naval maps of the areas where the exercises will occur show large areas where surveillance and reconnaissance will occur, along with direct action areas and insertion and extraction zones. According to the documents, a safety buffer of 500 to 1,000 meters will also be maintained by the Navy support team in boats, vehicles, and on foot, which will prevent bystanders from entering the areas. This amounts to periodic closings of public land, including state parks and fishing areas, with no public comment periods or government oversight. Given that some of the exercises will entail Navy SEALs swimming through marinas where people live on their boats, along with exercises and patrols through residential neighborhoods and private land, maintaining a safety barrier of 500 to 1,000 meters simply does not seem possible. One of the many areas slated for direct actions in the Navy's plan is Fort Worden State. Fort Worden State Park on the northeast tip of the Olympic Peninsula. The Navy has designated a large area atop a hill there, a place that contains popular public trails and picnic areas for its war exercises. The hilltop location includes a seating area for quiet contemplation called Memories Vault, which is referred to as a peace park. The public in the area will likely interpret the Navy's use of this portion of the park as another of the many gestures of contempt they have seen from the military. According to Karen Sullivan, former assistant regional director at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Division of External Affairs and a retired endangered species biologist, the Navy's actions are also illegal. Sullivan has worked in the division for over 15 years and is an expert in the bureaucratic procedures the Navy is supposed to be following. She's now part of the West Coast Action Alliance, one of two large multi-state international citizen groups that have tasked themselves with the watchdogging of the Navy due to what they believe are ongoing violations of the law, blatant acts of disrespect toward human and environmental health, and ongoing bellicose behavior by the military branch. According to Sullivan, the Navy's actions are a violation of several laws, including the National Environmental Policy Act, the Administrative Procedures Act, National Historic Preservation Act, and possibly others, as well as a violation of the public trust doctrine. She says they have exempted themselves from disclosing to the public and even to state and federal agencies the full scope and nature of their actions in order to segment them into smaller pieces that individually may look harmless but cumulatively have big impacts. That was the end of that quote. In one example, the Navy, without any consultation with the state of Washington, recently concluded that the war games would have no effect on historic and cultural properties, including those belonging to indigenous tribes, and therefore there was no need to consult with the state or with the tribes on the new sites for 2016. She goes on to express deep concerns about the exercises the Navy has planned for Washington and coastlines and the communities near them. She says having Navy SEAL kill teams in battle gear, conducting war games around private homes and private beaches, parks, campgrounds, and marinas is going to have a big effect on the people living and recreating there. Besides potentially creating public fear and confusion, the Navy will close off the areas they're wargaming in. Doesn't that require a public process? They go on to talk about the their concerns about the environmental impact. And I'm more concerned, honestly, about the human impact. They say the Navy is using an exemption process called a categorical exclusion, or CATEX, as a means of sidestepping federal regulation that could prohibit its use of these areas for exercises. By definition, a categorical exclusion is, quote, a category of actions which do not individually or cumulatively have a significant effect on the human environment, and for which, therefore, neither an environmental assessment or an environmental impact statement is required, unquote. According to an email obtained by Truthout, the Navy intends to issue its own CATEX on some of the SEAL activity as a means to segment and hide the full scope of its actions. Other communications have revealed that the Navy will retrofit an EA, or environmental assessment, for the big action, but will continue to CATEX pieces of it to keep it going. The email also said, quote, the Navy, without any consultation or concurrence with Washington's State Historical Preservation Officer, or SHPO, has concluded in the CATEX that there is no effect on historic properties and therefore no need to consult with the SHPO, unquote. The Navy's method essentially ensures that it will get its way and there is not going to be time for a full and legitimate environmental assessment and public process period between now and mid-January when it begins its exercises for at least the second year in a row. A glance at the Code of Federal Regulations citation for this shows that the Navy's actions are anything but uncontroversial, or anything but uncontroversial, or consistent with federal, state, or local laws. They certainly do not fall into the categories of public transportation, emergency utility repairs, or improvements to existing rest areas and way stations, for which categorical exclusions were originally intended. Hence, in the case of these upcoming exercises across Washington state coastlines, the Navy is issuing its own categorical exclusions for a massive amount of covert training in civilian populated areas. By doing so, it is circumventing state, local, and possibly federal governments by concluding no significant impacts in its own assessments. And it continues to proceed in secret. What I'm hearing here, folks, is dysfunctional government. What you're seeing, and you're seeing this kind of stuff at every level of government today. Government doesn't have to follow the rules. They're above the law. They can do anything they want. They don't. They set regulations and don't have to follow any law, any rule of law, any nothing. They do what they want. They're criminal. They're a criminal government enterprise. Organized crime, if you will. When they don't follow the law, they are criminals. That's the bottom line. And what is the chief law of the land? The Constitution. But this kind of stuff here is dysfunction. This kind of stuff is banana republic type of stuff, ladies and gentlemen. When the government doesn't follow the laws, you can't have... The thing is going to collapse eventually into chaos. And I ask again, how many other places across this country do we have this going on that we don't even know there are drills taking place? They say the Navy defines realistic military training, or RMT, as training that is conducted outside of federally owned property. Hence, according to that definition and according to the U.S. Military Special Operation Command, or SOCOM, the RMT, or Realistic Military Training Process, is theoretically designed to ensure coordination between the U.S. Department of Defense representatives and local and regional officials in the areas where their exercises are to be conducted. Steps like risk assessments, medical plans, surveys of training areas, and coordinating activities with local, state, and federal law enforcement officials are supposed to be mandatory. However, in the Navy's upcoming coastal exercise, not one of the measures listed by SOCOM has been offered to the public or to local or state officials in Washington, and no publicly available documentation exists that such measures have been even considered. According to SOCOM, the purpose of RMT, or Realistic Military Training, is to, quote, hone advanced skills and the military and interagency require large areas of undeveloped land with low population densities with access to small towns, unquote. Yet many of the areas outlined in the Navy's documents for their upcoming exercises take place in populated areas on developed land. You see, folks, this is urban warfare here. Urban warfare. At best, it's a psyop. Why would the military need to be training in urban populations? And, you know, and I remember talking about this before. We've had, you know, our board op at RBN when we were talking about it there. He was former military, and he said they build cities for this. They have places that they do this. They designed for this purpose. Why do they need to do it on the general population, non-military people? Everyday people. Why? Why is this necessary? Well, over 100,000 people live in Olympic Peninsula alone, they say, and Olympic Park National Park hosts 3 million visitors per year. Sullivan said that this is particularly galling, with Navy SEALs about to conduct insertions, extractions, launch and recovery, special reconnaissance, and other activities with simulated weapons in populated areas without the knowledge of the public. Training like that cannot be considered anything but RMT. The fact that the public is completely unaware of it, because the Navy has not notified them, despite legal obligations via the National Environmental Policy Act and policy obligations as described in the SOCOM presentation, is further evidence of its intent to deceive the public and circumvent the law, unquote. There are numerous other RMT-type events that have occurred around the United States in recent years, including urban training events in various communities around the country. A December 2015 U.S. Army report entitled Intelligence Support to Urban Operations addresses challenges facing military action in an urban environment. The manual states, quote, with the continuing growth in the world's urban areas and increasing population concentrations in urban areas, the probability that the Army will conduct operations in urban environments is ever more likely, unquote. Clearly, the Navy's training in Washington is also focused along these lines as well. The manual continues, quote, the enemy situation is often extremely fluid. Now listen to this, ladies and gentlemen. Because, see, here's the thing. We have a situation where the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act declared the United States a battlefield. Do you folks remember that? It was in the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act. And now we have these military drills without telling the public, without going through the proper channels, playing themselves out, and making the American people, non-military people, a part of the drill, sometimes without their knowledge. What I'm thinking here, and I've said this before, martial law is not going to be a sudden flip of the switch type event here in the United States. I think martial law in the United States is going to be a gradual, slow flipping of the country. until one day you look around you and all you see is military. All you see is troops. And don't think, in this day of internationalism, in this day of globalism, in this day where everything has to be swapped, we've got military troops, U.S. troops on foreign soil right now being commanded by commanders from foreign armies. This happens. So you don't think they're going to bring in foreign troops? Now, they're not saying that here. But I remember with the Jade Helm 15, which, by the way, is going to be a continuing thing as well, because they said as much. Jade Helm 15 was not a one-time operation. I distinctly remember that. There will be other Jade Helms. I don't know if they will be mastering the human domain as well, but isn't that what all of this stuff is? The point is, ladies and gentlemen, they were asked about the possibility. That guy, we played the audio on the show. We pointed it out at the time. The guy, one of the chief organizers of this event, this Jade Helm 15, was asked by the councilman that he was pitching this to use their local area, if military from foreign troops could be brought in to participate in this drill. His answer was, not at this time. Does that sound very promising to you, that this is just going to be a domestic military event? Not at this time? That's what he said. So, what do we have to look forward to here as these events play out? I'll tell you one thing we got to look forward to, and that's the bottom of the hour break. So I'll tell you what, we'll go ahead and take that, and we'll come back and we'll continue this and move on to other things. It's going to be a busy broadcast, and time's going to go by very quickly, I have a feeling. Stay with us. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks. We'll be back in a moment. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks. GovernAmerica.com is the website, www.GovernAmerica.com. My email address is radio@GovernAmerica.com. Greetings to all the folks in the chat room, chat.GovernAmerica.com. And greetings to all the folks listening to us on American Voice Radio Network. Glad to have you along. Thanks to Frank Steffen for doing what you do. And all the folks over there. In all of our micro stations, people reaching folks on the ground, thank you for what you do. As we move along here, I've been talking about the situation developing in Washington State, and I suspect there are other situations going on that we probably don't know about. And I'm talking about military operations where the public is being kept in the dark about what's happening. This is something everyone needs to be worried about. Why would they keep it in the dark? Why would they not disclose? Why would they not go through the proper channels? And furthermore, the starting point everyone needs to begin at is why all of a sudden this is all necessary? The military has had training operations in the past. They have bases for this sort of thing. Why is it necessary to interact with the public? Why is it necessary to intermingle with the public? Why was it necessary with Jade Helm 15 for them to go and interact and get help from the public? Unless they are gathering intel on the population to find out who will cooperate with them and who won't. And I think they just about as said as much. This Truth Out piece, Jamail writes, clearly the Navy's training in Washington is also focused along these lines as well. The lines of drilling in urban populations, being ever more likely. They say the enemy situation is often fluid. Locals, now get this, folks. This is the Army, this is the Navy's training manual. It says, quote, the enemy's situation is often extremely fluid. Locals friendly to us today may be tomorrow's belligerents. Adversaries seek to blend in with the local population to avoid being captured or killed. Enemy forces who are familiar with the city layout have an inherently superior awareness of the current situation. Why are the American people considered potential enemies? Why else would they be doing this, folks, if you folks weren't considered potential enemies? They've told you in their documents, returning military from foreign land, potential domestic terrorists. People who speak out too much, potential domestic terrorists. You got a Ron Paul bumper sticker on your car? Guess what? You're a potential domestic terrorist. Maybe you like the environment a little bit too much. Oh, you're a potential domestic terrorist. This is almost like a bad Jeff Foxworthy routine. You might be a terrorist if, fill in the blank. Every single American across this nation should be screaming about this, ladies and gentlemen. The federal government should not be involved in domestic war gaming, except in the confines of their own bases. There is no reason for this. There hasn't been any reason for this. Military training for combat in urban environments like the Navy's upcoming exercises in Washington has been ongoing at bases around the country with the goal of preparing soldiers for close contact engagements with urban environments. Now, you don't think martial law is going to take place here, ladies and gentlemen? You don't think something's coming? And I'm not trying to fearmonger, but we've been saying this for years, and that could be thrown back at me. You've been saying that for years. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen. Folks, it already is happening. But it's a gradual process. Everyone is expecting something sudden. And there may be some kind of economic cataclysmic event. As we see with the World Economic Forum going on right now, lots of doom and gloom out there about the economic situation. Some are saying the Federal Reserve should have never raised interest rates. We've had the markets nosediving so far this year. I think they were up a little bit yesterday. And normally we don't pay attention to the markets, because markets do what markets do, and they're notoriously volatile. But when they keep nosediving week after week, some questions have to be raised. Have they lost control? Have they lost their ability to rig things? Because that's everything today is rigged. The financial system is rigged. So they say, as recently as March 2015... in South Carolina, Operation Vigilant Guard saw large deployments of troops in civilian areas for training. Sullivan sees these actions, and in particular the upcoming naval exercises across Washington State, as an insidious light. Quote, the real story here is the fact that kill teams in training will be conducting covert operations in and around residential communities and on public lands without our knowledge, unquote, she said. Sullivan believes the general public needs to be concerned. I would think I would agree with Sullivan. About the Navy's actions, along with ongoing domestic military expansion as a whole, because they both present, quote, an unprecedented and unlawful taking of public land and private space for military activity, unquote. She points out that there is no plausible justification for the Navy's excursion into urban areas. The Navy has millions of acres of Department of Defense land to train in, Sullivan said. Now they're using and closing portions of our national forests. Why do they need to invade our neighborhoods, too? And that's the point, listeners. You know, I remember the Boston bombing thing happened. The alleged Boston bombing thing, event. You know, the thing where they had a drill, another drill going on, coinciding with the actual event. Yeah, that Boston bombing thing. You know, where one of the marathon participants said, oh, don't pay any attention to the bomb-sniffing dogs. They're just here for the drill. They shut down the entire city, ladies and gentlemen, while they went door to door, violating people's rights to search for this little teenager, this little kid. And I remember looking at that and telling you folks, this is a turning point in America. And here we are. It keeps going down the road of totalitarian control, militaristic incursions into our life on a daily basis, on a regular basis, increasingly. Oh, but I guess I'm just a tinfoil hat wearer, aren't I? I'm just concerned about nothing. There's nothing to see here. Move along. Carry on with your life. Anyway, finishing this up, she also sees another threat from the Navy's exercises in state parks and private lands, the normalization of military activity in our lives and in places where it has historically never been. Like Gallant, Sullivan is not opposed to military conducting trainings in itself. She objects to the training happening in places where people live, work, recreate, and without the informed consent of the public. We object to the shell game that is passed for public process. We object to the Navy's apparent contempt for the laws of the land and to the fact that the military is steadily moving off the millions of acres of land. Now get this, folks, because she's right. The military is steadily moving off the millions of acres of land the public has given it for training in order to practice warfare among us, the very citizens it is supposed to protect. That's because the citizens are the enemy. Those are my words, not hers. You've been declared so by your government. This Dar Jamail, who wrote that piece, was interviewed. He's a Truth Out reporter, broke the story. He was interviewed by Jessica Devereaux from The Real News, and I want to play a little bit of the interview so that they can elaborate a little bit on this, because I think this is very important. And then after that, we'll move on to other things.
It's not safe because you're going to have SEALs carrying simulated weapons into state parks, residential areas, private property. These exercises could take place anytime, day or night, without any public notice given in advance whatsoever. And so most of the people in these areas where they're going to take place have no idea even what's coming. So the potential for disaster is there. If someone wakes up in the middle of the night and sees a group of armed men walking outside their house, or if there's SEALs coming up in marina areas where people are living on boats, this type of thing has a lot of potential for things to not end well. What we're seeing in Washington now really is kind of a smaller example of what happened during Operation Jade Helm. No public notifications given. When I released this story and released these documents on Truth Out on Monday, a bit of a maelstrom erupted across the Pacific Northwest region because the governor's office wasn't aware of it. State and local officials, things like U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, local fishing authorities. So what happens when SEALs decide they're going to close off an entire beachhead area and a 1,000-meter perimeter around it, as it says they will in their documentation. Mm-hmm. So people were very, very disturbed by this.
But the next question, the obvious one, is why? Why wouldn't you give the public notice? You mentioned in your article that many are claiming that this is, in fact, illegal. And you quote Karen Sullivan of the West Coast Action Alliance, who says that the Navy is violating the National Environmental Policy Act, Administrative Procedures Act, National Historic Preservation Act. It goes on and on, possibly others, as well as violating the public trust, of course. Can you explain how they're even able to circumvent these laws? And why hasn't there been more of a public process?
All of those are very important points. And a lot of my sources in the story, like Karen Sullivan, who you mentioned, believe the primary reason is it just really shows a naval contempt towards the public process and towards the authorities that they're supposed to be working with in order to conduct these exercises in the right way. And instead of doing so, they went to great lengths to really secretively try to push forward with this and just do it without having to go through the normal channels. In fact, one of the things they did, the documents that I published on Monday on Truth Out, as well as a lot of the emails that I got access to in order to write this story, the Navy had labeled the relevant files, quote, for official use only, and then some of them labeled as attorney-client privilege. Now, that doesn't mean that they're necessarily exempt from public access, but it did exempt all those files from a Freedom of Information Act. So it was clearly an overt attempt by the Navy to try to secretize what they were doing and keep these files off the public record. And so when we publish them, that's why it's caused so much of a hoopla around the Pacific Northwest. All of these state and local officials very, very angry at being bypassed and left out of a bureaucratic process that by law the Navy is required to follow.
Dar, you also mentioned in your article domestic military expansion and this being sort of an example of that. Can you just talk about that a little bit?
It is a very worrisome trend, and I've been seeing it firsthand up where I live in Washington State and across the Pacific Northwest with what the Navy's doing. But as you brought up earlier, Operation Jade Helm is another blatant example that occurred last year. And we're seeing this all across the country, whether it's naval exercises or exercises on land that are where the military is literally intentionally operating in areas where they know they're going to be civilians as part of their war games to train to both train the soldiers in how to deal with civilians and treat them as possible belligerents, to use their own lingo, as well as, I think, kind of a dangerous desensitization among the civilian population to getting used to having military hardware and soldiers walking around with guns among the civilian populations. It's a very, very worrisome thing, and I would cite two articles in the Quadrennial Defense Review report from the Pentagon where they say that they are gearing up and training for potential unrest in light of another giant economic crisis in this country, or potential unrest that could be generated from ramifications of climate disruption, things like drought, lack of available food resources, etc. So it is stated within even the military's own documentation that part of the aims of these exercises is to prepare the military for these things that they expect could come.
All right, this is some scary stuff, and I'm sure people are wondering what they can do about this. So, Dar, just really quickly, what would you recommend?
Well, I think it's a very important time for people to contact their political representatives on a state level and local level and alert them that they're very concerned about this and look into what's going on in their own communities, because as usual, nothing's going to happen if people just sit by and allow these things to progress and grow worse, which is what's happening right now.
Everybody should be concerned, and everybody should do exactly what he says. We need to put a stop to this, ladies and gentlemen, because as he said, it's just going to keep getting worse unless you take action. This is one of the reasons why we do programs like this, is to try to increase our numbers, get more people on board, making more people aware of what's going on and directing them to the proper action, because there's plenty out there that are trying to distract. You notice I don't talk a whole lot about the presidential race here on this program because it's a waste of time. Waste of time supporting these candidates. It's a waste of time worrying about whether Donald Trump or Ron Paul or Rand Paul or whoever else is going to be the puppet in the Oval Office. I don't even talk about congressional campaigns. Anybody on a federal level is easy to control for them. They love to get people with skeletons in their closet that they can easily blackmail. I really think that that's why a lot of this NSA spying is going on. It's for no other purpose than blackmail. To learn what somebody's been up to so that they can turn around and threaten them with the information to go make it public if they don't go along. So as we have these military drills taking place, we also have other things also going along with it. None of this would have come to light, ladies and gentlemen, had it not been for a journalist that you just heard from bringing this to you apart from the establishment media. Because the establishment media is asleep at the switch, I think, deliberately, when it comes to this. So it took the truth media to bring this out. Now you have in South Carolina a bill to squelch the media. South Carolina bill to register determined competency of journalists. This comes from Activist Post, Brandon Turbeville. South Carolina has long been known for the ridiculous and off-world bills its state house regularly submits to a vote. Indeed, the residents of the state are routinely subjected to a demonstration of the utter uselessness of the majority of its representatives, as well as their lack of understanding and concern for civil liberties, constitutional rights, and the general welfare of the state. Enter another freedom-shredding bill submitted by the constitutional non-scholar Mike Pitts, a Republican state House member from Lawrence, South Carolina. Pitt's bill would establish a responsible journalism registry. Unbelievable. Responsible journalism registry to be operated by the South Carolina Secretary of State. The summary of the bill states that it would establish requirements for persons before working as a journalist, for a media outlet, and for media outlets before hiring a journalist, as well as establish penalties, fines, and jail sentences for violations. And, of course, always for other purposes. H. 4702 states, quote, "A person seeking to register shall provide all information required by the office, including but not limited to a criminal record background check, an affidavit from media outlet attesting to the applicant's journalistic competence, and an application fee in an amount determined by the office. A registration is valid for 2 years and must be renewed. So don't make any waves. It must be renewed within 30 days of expiration. Better not question too much. Better not report too much government unfriendly stuff. Or you just might not be renewed. And your career go right down the commode. The Secretary of State office may deny, revoke, or refuse to issue or renew a registration if the office finds that the person has filed an application for registration that contains a statement that is false or misleading with respect to a material fact, has failed to pay the proper application fee or any fee or penalty imposed pursuant to this chapter, or C, has failed to comply with any provision of the chapter. Secretary of State's office shall deny, revoke, or refuse to issue or renew a registration if a media outlet has determined pursuant to Section 40-85-40 that a person is not competent to be a journalist." I'm laughing. It's not funny. I'm only laughing because this is so absurd. But ladies and gentlemen, your state could be doing it next. You don't dare make a wave if you're at their behest. And I've bemoaned the fact that the national establishment media is in bed with the politicians in Washington, D.C. That there is a video up on GovernAmerica.com on our YouTube channel that I put there in conjunction with writing an article that I wrote about how Marie Harf was gifting journalist, AP journalist Matt Lee for his birthday. Brings in all these balloons. The White House Press Club. They wine and dine. The media establishment media. Why do you think they do this? Oh, we're all just people. We're having a good time. No. No, you don't have a good time with people that you're supposed to be covering, with people you're supposed to be exposing. The role, the First Amendment role of the media in this country is to expose, is to uncover, is to investigate, is to whistleblow. That's the whole point of the First Amendment. You don't hobnob with the people that you're covering. But they do. Tell you what, I got a caller on the line. I'll go ahead and take the caller. Hello, caller, you're on the air. Who do we have?
This is the journalism police, sir.
How you doing?
I'm doing all right. Well, I heard this the other day. This is unbelievable. This is their goal. They really would rather make it only for the CNNs of the world and the Fox News to be able to have any broadcast capabilities whatsoever. The fact that somebody like you is on the air and people love you and you bring the truth as much as you can find it to the people, that's not going to be allowed. They're trying day and night. They've been working on this for years. How the hell they can shut you down and people like you and anybody that speaks one word out of the realm? So congratulations for you for being there. And to see how long you can do it, because they'll bring in the theatrical. I mean, we're joking, but you know what? They will have the Gestapo coming and haul you away in this once free country. This cannot be allowed, my friend.
Well, that can't happen here. You don't think that's going to happen here, do you? I'm kidding.
Yep. No, maybe, I mean, you know, you could... Maybe they'll have to use a drone on you. They'll do something. Maybe you'll get a nice missile in your Mercedes, like they did to Michael Hastings a year and a half ago.
Yeah, well, I wish I had a Mercedes. I didn't. You know, I'd have to have a Mercedes first. Hey, you want to hold over the break?
I'd love to. Thank
okay,
you.
Hold on just a second. We got the top of the hour break. Stay with us, folks. We'll be back in a moment. This is Govern America. Hour number two is straight ahead. All right, we're back. This is Govern America, hour number two, as we continue on here. Got Harvey from Florida on the line. And we're talking about the situation right now with the South Carolina bill, and it's probably coming to a state near you if this thing passes. And this is our concern, ladies and gentlemen. There's a reason why we have a First Amendment in this country, as Harvey was saying before the break, and that is the fact that we are supposed to expose. The media is supposed to be exposing the politicians that are engaging in these types of activities. We don't have that anymore. They've fallen down on the job. Well, they've just given up on the job. They're compromised. They're in bed together. And increasingly, we have CIA agents, former Pentagon officials, former people who are involved in the military-industrial complex, being involved also various other intelligence agencies going into the media, the national media, and reporting events as experts. They're called in. Council on Foreign Relations. These are the experts that they're telling you what's going on in these war zones. Do you think it's going to be geared toward trying to steer public opinion away from perpetual war? I don't think so. and just talking about not allowing drills here, they can accuse you of being anti-military. This is a real problem, and it goes in line to this false patriotism that is constantly being pushed all across this country. What do you think of that, Harvey? False patriotism is pretty much a scourge. Go ahead.
I'll tell you something. Yeah, Dan. If you listen to National Public Radio, and especially the Diane Rehm show, is nothing but a propaganda arm of the U.S. government.
Oh, yeah.
She has on her program every day. And I can't get through. They won't let me get through to her anymore. But plus, if you ask a question of their supposed experts, the experts are nothing more but think tank millionaires. Think tank millionaires, CIA operatives of every description, one after the other. They parade them. And all the NPR news shows, they happen to find somebody from the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, almost every person whose opinion you hear. So they can't have too many independents. Now, back to Michael Hastings, if you remember correctly, in the beginning of the Iraq invasions, he was reporting exactly as the government said, and he was doing fine. But once he turned on and started doing some truthful stories, especially about General Petraeus, that's when he got the missile and his car exploded, and, of course, he's been murdered. So, and I can see right now the think tanks and the Googles and the Microsofts right now are working on a device that when you're sitting in front of your computer broadcasting, it will sense a truthful tale, and it will nuke you. You will get a missile right from your computer, a little death device, come right out of your computer on a little microchip ray of some type, and if you dare to tell the truth on the air, we're going to take this to its logical conclusion. You will be zapped right there in your chair there in Michigan somewhere.
That's a real optimistic assessment there, Harvey.
Well, you can see where it's heading. I used to tell the people on my radio show, I used to see, you know, they would sit and laugh when we were invading Iraq, murdering mothers and children. Not just murdering, blowing them to bits. Thousands and thousands, and then it became a million people. They blew to bits in Iraq, and the American people were sitting there drinking their beers, laughing, say, go get them, go get them. But everything they did to those people in Iraq, all that experimental equipment they tried there, they tested there, they were all using it on you. Only a matter of time. And I'm telling you, they'll have a truth-sensing device built into the computer, and a little ray that'll come out, and if somebody like you, well, if they have the law already that says you have to have a licensed broadcaster, if you're an unlicensed broadcaster, you're going to get a little surprise there from your computer device.
Yeah, well, that's the over-the-air thing. We're broadcasting on the internet, but there are stations that carry us. But the point is that, you know, with this FCC thing becoming ever more prominent, I think, you know, it could very well be a day where they require a license to broadcast on the internet too.
Well, of course, you know, I used to broadcast on an AM station. It was one of the last independent stations in South Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And that guy was a Bulgarian. The guy that owned the station was a Bulgarian refugee, and he had built a fortune building radio and television broadcasting, and mostly would broadcast back to Europe and all. And he came here to seek freedom. When he saw what was going on, he told me I can say and do anything I want on his radio waves, and he'll protect me. And he did. And I had a free show. But it was only a matter of time before those last few independents. Now, at that time, they were letting Clear Channel buy up every major network. So all the powerful signals are all owned by Clear Channel,
yep,
which, thanks to Bill Clinton and his predecessors, they let them buy 1,400 powerful radio stations all across America. So all you hear is Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, who are all government agents.
Yep, market to market.
They don't pay them $30 million a year to tell the truth. How much do you get paid to tell the truth there, Darren?
Not a penny.
Well, that's what, and neither did I. And neither did I, but I broadcast regardless of it. So I'm telling you, this is the logical conclusion. They can't allow this much longer because you and a few handful of people like you have. Remember Dr. Stan Monteith?
Oh yeah.
These people are so brilliant and so wonderful, and they gave up a career in order just to broadcast a little bit of truth that was able to get out. So I have to applaud you, and I thank you for being there. And,
well, I appreciate the encouragement.
Keep up the great work, as you really cover all the bases, my friend.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the call, Harvey. God bless you.
Yep, have a beautiful day.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye. There he is, Harvey in Florida, ladies and gentlemen. There's a lot of good people in this movement. And unfortunately, a lot of the folks that are out there don't have a platform. And this is why the alternative media is very important, to give people a platform. By the way, the phone number, if you'd like to call in, 844-646-8376. That's toll-free, 844-646-8376. Once again, 844-646-8376. Or you can remember it by going toll-free, 1-844-6-GOVERN. As we move along here, I think I want to leave that bill there. It goes on to define what a journalist is, but you can get to this on the website. It's also, it originally came from the Activist Post. South Carolina bill to register determined competency of journalists. Dangerous stuff, listeners. Yes, it's one state, but often these things spread. It gets passed there. So you folks, if you live in South Carolina, need to make sure you kill this bill. In the meantime, we mentioned earlier, you know, the military drills. Why is all this going on? We have the World Economic Forum underway. Gloom and doom prevails. Michael Snyder, 2016 market meltdown. We have never seen a year start quite like this. He says we're about 3 weeks into 2016, and we are witnessing things we have never seen before. There are two emergency market shutdowns in China. Within the first four trading days of this year, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has never lost this many points within the first 3 weeks, and just yesterday, we learned that global stocks had officially entered bear market territory. Overall, more than $15 trillion, listeners, of global stock market wealth has been wiped out since last June. And of course, the markets are simply playing catch-up with global economic reality. The Baltic Dry Index just hit another new all-time record low. Walmart has announced that they are shutting down 269 stores. I believe they were laying off 1,000 people, if I remember correctly. Initial jobless claims in the U.S. has surged to their highest level in 6 months. Oh, but don't worry. The media, the establishment media, you know, the people that we were just talking about a moment ago, yeah, they'll just continue to report the U3 number, which leaves most of everybody out of the picture. These are the games they play. Bureau of Labor Statistics and the media completely on board with the U3 number. Anyway, initial jobless claims. Folks, again, I'll say, if you want the real number, the real purpose, the real economic picture as far as your joblessness is concerned, go to governamerica.com and look at that BLS chart. The Bureau of Labor Statistics chart pulls it right from their site, right from their server. When you load the page, it goes and gets it every time. And I did that for a purpose, because if it changes, it'll be there. It'll update right there on the site. But that workforce participation rate chart tells the whole story about your economic recovery. Right in the center column on the main page. Take a look at that workforce participation rate chart, and you tell me that there's a recovery in this country. When a good portion of the population has quit. Not quit, but why would they not be in the labor force? Why would they not be participating? Because there are no jobs, listeners. Your jobs have been outsourced deliberately to foreign countries. And what jobs that you haven't had outsourced deliberately through free trade globalization schemes, you've had foreigners imported into the country to take those. Illegals, migrants, refugees, listeners. So, the Baltic Dry Index This hit another new all-time record low today. Walmart has announced that they are shutting down 269 stores, and initial jobless claims in the U.S. has surged to their highest level in 6 months. So if things are this bad today, what will the rest of 2016 bring? Sunshine and birdies? Blue skies? The Dow was up just a little bit on Thursday, thankfully. But even if with that gain, we are still seeing unprecedented territory. According to CNBC, we have never seen a tougher start to the year for the Dow than we have in 2016. They say the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which was created in 1896, has never begun a year with 12 worse trading days. Through Wednesday's close, the Dow has fallen 9.5%, even including the 1.3% gains as of noon Thursday. The Dow is still down nearly 8% in 2016. Well, Market Watch says data from the U.S. Federal Reserve, meanwhile, say non-financial corporate stocks are now valued at about 90% of their replacement cost of company assets, a metric known as Tobin's Q. But the historic average going back a century is in the region of 60% of replacement costs. By this measure, stocks could fall, they say, and this is MarketWatch, mainstream media listeners. By this measure, stocks could fall another third, taking the Dow all the way down to 10,000. Keep in mind, lest you think that we are being alarmist, Telegraph out of the UK, remember, RBS, Royal Bank of Scotland, cries, sell everything as deflationary crisis nears. Clients told to seek the safety of bonds and treasuries. This is about the return of capital, not return on capital. In a crowded hall, exit doors are small, they say. Ambrose Evans Pritchard says RBS, Royal Bank of Scotland, listener, major bank, has advised clients to brace for a cataclysmic year and a global deflationary crisis, warning that major stocks could fall by a fifth and oil may plummet to $16 a barrel. The bank's credit team said markets are flashing stress alerts akin to the turbulent months before the Lehman crisis in 2008. Sell everything except high-quality bonds. This is about the return of capital, not a return on capital. In a crowded hall, exit doors are small, it said in a client note. Andrew Roberts, the bank's research chief for European economics and rates, said the global trade in loans and loans are contracting, a nasty cocktail for corporate balance sheets and equity earnings. This is particularly ominous given that global debt ratios have reached record highs. Quote, China has set off a major correction and it is going to snowball. Equities and credit have become very dangerous, and we are hardly even begun to retrace the Goldilocks love in of the past 2 years, he said. Mr. Roberts expects Wall Street and European stocks to fall by 10% to 20%, with even a deeper slide for the FTSE 100, given its high weighting of energy and commodities companies. London is vulnerable to a negative shock, they say. All these people who are long on oil and mining companies, thinking that the dividends are safe, are going to discover that they're not safe at all, he said. So, anyway, oil has rebounded some in the last couple of days, I notice. And who knows? The point is that things are not looking well, and things haven't looked well for a decade or more. When you have a massive amount of debt, and that debt basically drives everything. We pay our debt with debt because the money is debt. This is the money magician operation that's going on in this day and age. Anyway, I mentioned we had the World Economic Forum going on right now. And uh, Let's see. I'm not finding what I'm looking for. Here we go. Here's a little backgrounder on the World Economic Forum.
Over 40 heads of state and government will join CEOs, NGO leaders, and Hollywood stars for their annual attempt to try to plot a way through the world's complexities at this year's World Economic Forum in Davos in the Swiss Alps. The theme of this year's meeting is the Fourth Industrial Revolution, which WEF founder and chairman Klaus Schwab describes as the fusion of technologies across the physical, digital, and biological worlds, which is creating entirely new capabilities and dramatic impacts on political, social, and economic systems. Klaus Schwab, the 77-year-old chief of the world's most recognized annual economic meeting, said he's worried about Europe's future, the fallout from plunging oil prices, and gaping inequalities worldwide. With the world facing a myriad of problems such as climate change and war, Schwab said he wanted a forward-looking theme to dominate discussions this year, which officially runs from Wednesday through to Saturday, and has built this edition around the idea of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. As for Europe's struggle to manage an influx of more than 1 million refugees and migrants last year, he said the continent was at a crossing point. Europe needs to find the right balance between its values and its capabilities of taking them in and assuage tensions that have put the Schengen zone, which eases cross-border travel, to the test, he said.
I don't know why they have to play that background music. It seems kind of odd. But anyway, she mentioned Klaus Schwab. He's the executive chairman of the World Economic Forum, ladies and gentlemen. And he's saying that the refugee crisis in Europe could be a precursor to something much bigger. We're being flooded. Europe is being flooded. We've talked about the assaults, the sexual assaults on the people there, and how it seems that these refugees are being brought in and being allowed to prey upon the women in these other countries. Now, this Klaus Schwab, who is the chairman of the World Economic Forum, listen to what he had to say about the current situation right now with regard to the financial system.
It's not new for me. I mean, let's not forget we are moving in cycles, but the world has become much more interconnected. So what may be...
Now, why do you think the world has become much more interconnected, ladies and gentlemen? He says that like it just magically happened. It just magically happened that the world has all of a sudden become No, folks, it's these globalists like Klaus Schwab that has made the world become increasingly interconnected, like all the bankers and the financial people at the World Economic Forum. So, yes, the world has become increasingly connected because it's globalists pushing this, pushing the agenda. This stuff doesn't just happen.
...is that this slowing down, this volatility, vulnerability takes part practically everywhere, in every sector and so on. And I would say it's reinforced also by the consequences of the Fourth Industrial Revolution.
Do you think now it's possible...
The Fourth Industrial Revolution.
...that a slowdown in the emerging world could bring down the economies of U.S. and Europe?
Yes, but what we see at the moment is a rather small acceleration of economic growth in the developed world,
yeah,
and a deceleration in the developing emerging world. I would say we shouldn't underestimate the consequences of, let's say, lower commodity prices, oil, of course. We shouldn't discount the vulnerability in terms of foreign exchange exposure of some countries. So I would be positive, but I would foresee for the developed world, but I would see the potential for quite substantial shocks.
Did you hear that, folks? Quite substantial. He sees potential for quite substantial shocks. I want to play that one more time. What you're hearing here is the executive chairman of the World Economic Forum talking about how basically they are losing, the experts, quote unquote, the experts are losing control of the financial system.
So I would be positive, but I would foresee for the developed world, but I would see the potential for quite substantial shocks.
The Fed has just commenced a tightening cycle, which a lot of people think may not be a wise idea, or it may not be good timing for that. How do you see the Fed's role in this?
What do you see?
Okay, now, first of all, I want you to really pay attention to what he says next. Because regarding the Federal Reserve, the raising of the interest rates, this Klaus Schwab, chairman of the World Economic Forum, ladies and gentlemen, he goes on to basically say they don't know what they're doing. They don't know what to do. They try this, they try that. They don't know what the results are going to be.
You see, just we are in uncharted territory. And we don't know, we make a decision like the Fed, and we don't know what actually the consequences are.
Yeah.
The unexpected consequences. I would say we are living in times of unexpected consequences. Whatever your decision you take, you do not know exactly what will happen. So we are not completely in control of what's happening. And this leads also to erosion of trust of the people in decision makers.
Well, why would we trust you? We don't know. You don't know what you're doing. You just, ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard the head of the World Economic Forum admit that the money magicians at the Federal Reserve and other central bankers around the world have run out of tricks. He just said that they are making decisions. They don't know what the impacts of the decisions are going to be. How does that make you feel? Knowing that the experts are playing a game of trial and error with the stability of the financial system. I'll tell you what it makes me feel. Maybe we should be getting ready. Maybe personal preparedness might be a good idea, huh? Because they're certainly not going to be looking out for your best interest. No, they're going to be off on their yachts and their underground bunkers as the stuff hits the fan and the military is, well, these drills become permanent and they're no longer drills anymore. Why do you think they're drilling, listeners? Could it be because they know they've lost control of the financial system? Could it be that they're out of tricks and they know it? Could it be that the tinfoil hat conspiracy kooks were right once again? Anyway, they go on to talk about the refugee crisis in Europe.
How do you see the oil crash continuing to play out and changing the way the global economy looks?
I'm particularly concerned about the political and maybe humanitarian consequences. Look how many countries in...
Oh, yeah, he's such a humanitarian, isn't he? All these banker clowns, all these business people, and these multinational corporations and big banks. Oh, they're so concerned. They're such humanitarians.
Africa, for example, depend on the income from oil exports. Now, just imagine 1 billion inhabitants. Imagine they all move north. So it could be that the present refugee problem which we have now in Europe is just a precursor of what could come if you add in addition the possible water crisis and so on. So I'm very concerned that this lowering of commodity prices leads to a substantial social breakdown in a number of countries.
Speaking of the European refugee crisis, do you feel that anybody has a good handle on what to do about it, or are leaders still sort of lost and poking for a solution?
I think we probably have to redefine the word refugee to make sure that those who are really in need find the necessary protection. And then we have to look what we do with those who are more economic refugees. I do not have a recipe, but I know, I mean, we have to protect also one of our European values, and this is solidarity, this is having a heart for other people. I'm torn myself, because on the one hand, I would like to help those people as much
as possible. Sure, of course.
On the other hand, I'm very concerned what the final impact on populations will be.
Very concerned. Very concerned. He'd really like to help them. Very concerned. Yeah, such a humanitarian. Listen, sir, if you're really concerned about the humanitarian issues, then why don't you tell your banker buddies who start the wars that create the refugee crisis to knock it off, huh? It's your members at the World Economic Forum, Mr. Schwab, who start the wars for profit. There's absolutely no reason why the Syrian conflict, for instance, which we're told led to this refugee crisis, should have been instigated in the first place. It was the U.S. instigated war in Syria which begat the so-called refugee and humanitarian crisis over there. So how does the U.S. and allied countries fit into your World Economic Forum, Mr. Schwab? Aren't they members? Aren't they prominent players? So sorry if I'm a little skeptical of your concerns about people. Speaking of refugees,
a small window into a global humanitarian crisis. The day in the life of a refugee experience at Davos gives delegates a chance to stand in the shoes of a displaced person. The hour-long simulation run by the Crossroads Foundation has former refugees and NGO workers act as soldiers and camp bosses.
Put your hands on the wall.
The UN says the number of displaced people worldwide jumped to nearly 60 million last year, much of that increased due to the conflict in Syria.
More than a million migrants and refugees arrived in Europe last year. As yet, there are no signs that 2016 will see a decline in numbers.
Divisions have been widening within the EU over how to handle the crisis and over the number of arrivals that European countries can absorb. The head of Oxfam says Europe can't turn away.
I think European countries need to be encouraged to do more.
To do more! Europe, you're not doing enough! You need to let more in, she says. Unbelievable. Bottom of the hour, we'll be back in a moment.
What your government will do for you. Ask what your government is doing to you.
All right, we're back. This is Govern America. GovernAmerica.com is the website. www.governamerica.com. At the top of the hour, we should have, if everything goes as planned, Vicki Davis. She's going to come up and give us an update on the Bureau of Land Management, the situation out at Malheur. I have not mentioned that today. I hasn't so far because I've been saving it for the final hour. There's really talks going on with the FBI and stuff out there right now. Whether that will go anywhere or not, remains to be seen, but we'll talk about that a little bit in about a half an hour. In the meantime, we were talking about the financial situation. Everything seems to be hanging by a thread. Christine Lagarde, the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, criminal cartel, listeners, has given China's leadership, according to The Independent out of the UK, a harsh dose of reality by laying bare the challenges it faced transforming into a service-led economy. Now, how many times, where have we heard this before? A service-led economy. wasn't that when they sent our industry south of the border and over to China? We became a service-led economy? Now they're saying we have a knowledge-based economy? That means you've got no economy left, listeners. Which is why we have massive runaway, which is why we have Walmart closing 200-something stores. Because the stores are no longer profitable. Have people quit shopping? People only buy what they need in many respects today. Anyway, the Asian powerhouse, they say, is seeking to leave behind its reliance on heavy industry and transform itself into an economy driven by consumer consumption and services. It will take a little time, but we believe China will deliver, Ms. Lagarde told an audience at the World Economic Forum in Davos. She says, I have no doubt it will happen. She also said that China should communicate better with financial markets. China's stock exchanges have had a roller coaster ride over the past 6 months, with authorities trying to various measures to stem the volatility of the main Shanghai share index. Why is China struggling, listeners? China has been built upon a lie, in my opinion. The whole thing is propped up with fake cities, unoccupied ghost cities that they've been building over there. You can only build so many ghost cities until you run out of productivity. You run out of space to build ghost cities. And the economic development, economic expansion that they've had is due to the fact that the American people have continued to buy cheap Chinese-made garbage produced over there by the slaves of U.S. corporations and international corporations. Slave labor over in communist China. Well, that can only happen for as long as there's enough jobs here to maintain that balance. Obviously, this is no longer the case. Workforce participation rate nosedives. Despite what the media tells you, the economic picture here is bleak. We're in a depression, listeners. And that's the bottom line. And now you're seeing it. Now they can't gloss over it anymore. There's enough laid off people in this country. And then there's enough economic gloom out there. And I'm not trying to be a pessimist. I'm not trying to depress you. I'm just telling you how it is. George Soros, if you don't believe me, listen to him. He's talking about deflation. He's talking about how bad it is.
Just 2 weeks ago, you said that actually we should be much more careful because there's a risk of repeating what happened in 2008.
Yeah. Well, 2008, we are repeating it. It was a time of a financial crisis and a bear market. And you have the same condition today. But the source of the disequilibrium is different. In 2008, the root cause was the subprime crisis in America. Now the root cause is basically China. So it's not comparable.
China because growth is much below what we think, or because they're importing deflation if they devalue the yuan?
It's deflation and over-indebtedness of the Chinese economy. The total social debt is down 300%, and maybe actually it might be up to 350 if you take into account the external debt. So it's serious, and the Chinese left it too long to address the changeover in the growth model that they have to adopt from, you know, investment and export led to domestic led. So a hard landing is practically unavoidable.
Did you hear that, ladies and gentlemen?
You're looking at
Hold on a second. Did you hear that? A hard landing. This is billionaire George Soros, who himself is a scumbag, but he does know a little bit about financial stuff. You don't get to be a billionaire unless you know a little bit about how things work. And he's saying a hard landing is unavoidable. All right, finishing this up.
Landing is practically unavoidable.
So you're looking at a financial crisis that would start in China when authorities also couldn't deal with it.
Well, it's one of the they're basically the key issue is deflation. Now you don't. It's a condition that we are not used to. None of us have lived in a deflationary environment. The last time we had that is in the 1930s. And while I was around, I was not yet engaged in the markets. We just don't know how to handle it. It's a different environment. But now...
Ben, did you hear that, ladies and gentlemen? Again, he's saying we don't know how to handle it. It's out of our control. We don't know how to deal. Do you hear the theme going on here? They've lost control of the markets. They've lost control of the financial system.
We have to face it.
But on China, do you expect actually a hard landing?
Well, it has happened. I'm not expecting it. I'm just observing it. But China can manage it. It's got resources. It has a greater latitude in choosing policies than most other countries, because it has over $3 trillion of reserves and so on. However, they have a way of inflicting their problem, passing it on to the rest of the world. So they can handle it, even if they don't get the transition right. They can certainly continue for 2-3 years on the wrong course. But the effect on the rest of the world, and that is actually mainly deflation.
I hope you folks are seeing the theme here. There's a real problem going on here. They have lost control, ladies and gentlemen. All right, we got a caller on the line. Go ahead, caller. Who do we have?
Hi, Darren. This is Steve in Texas.
Hey, Steve. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Hey, pardon my noise for a second as I pull over and kind of park. I'm on my way to town. I planned on calling in earlier before you were talking about finance, but we can go there. Hey, so he said that China has the natural resources. That was kind of a cute little key. And you think about the crash and, you know, Soros and what are the resources? And he wasn't talking natural resources. He was kind of talking the human resources as well, or HR, or whatever, you know, because they do have slave labor out there. And so, well, we got here in the United States a bunch of people that work allegedly for money, and then they get free money and so forth. So when we hit this hard crash, he focused in on, well, China, because they had both natural resources and manpower, and we don't have that. But that's my take on that bit. But going back to that, how do we create our own, you know, resources here locally for when we hit the hard stop? You talked earlier about the squashing of, well, independent media.
Right.
Well, that's kind of big for me, because I'm a listener to the show, and you've affected more people in my area than you'll ever know. And I've been leveraging you for a long time as far as to get the message out and deal with city council and the county commissioners and all this other stuff.
I appreciate that.
And I do my own broadcasting because of it, because of your show. You've kind of empowered me and let me move on. But we do need to kind of start thinking about when they start silencing our voices. Art, a little bit, Art Off the Grid was in the chat room, and I so love the fact that he's just off the grid and not just going, man, these guys are all crazy out here. Why would I want to be on another list? And I was that way when I moved to Texas. And it was kind of like, you know, screw this. I don't want to put my head up and do anything. And I'm not saying anybody else should get up and go to city council meetings. I'm not saying that at all. But what I am saying is, as the independent media, if you're so inclined, you need to stand up and keep talking and plan for the day when, well, I guess we are on some kind of list, probably, Darren, because I talk about the city council and I talk about the cities and all this, you know, politics.
Well, I can tell you, they listen to the broadcast. They've been on this stream.
Yeah.
They've been on the stream for like 2 or 3 weeks now. We started talking about the Mount Keir National Wildlife Refuge occupation, and Washington, D.C.'s, their IP address popped up on the stream and has never went away. That's very persistent. I can take the stream down, bring it right back up, and immediately they reconnect. So I know they're listening, and I have no doubt they're recording everything. But you know what? We're not doing anything illegal here.
Well, that's wonderful.
We're sharing information to the general population, sharing about what happened to the country. And if that makes us terrorists, then that says a lot about what the government is up to and who's running things.
You know, Darren, when it's a wonderful thing that they're listening, right? I know that only a handful of people are actually monitoring your stream and, you know, actually listening. But then that's education in itself, and maybe they can take a look at it. Some of my more important things that I've covered, I know law enforcement was listening. And it's a time that I get to actually talk to them at a human level and say, do you think this is right? And some of the stuff that's happening out in Oregon, you know, you got a lot of people that are down on them, a lot of people that are, you know, fanboys. But, you know, it's a problem that we have with the government taking land from everybody slowly over time. And it's just not right. It's not how we should behave as humans towards one another. And it's just wonderful. But all I wanted to say is independent media is really important, and so is your show. Support Govern America. You guys, you know, we got to keep this on the air. I wholeheartedly support you and all my friends out here in Fredericksburg. Please donate, and if you can't donate directly through the internet, contact me, and I will get together and I'll get some money over to Darren, because I know he needs, money to support this operation.
I appreciate
that.
That's
all I have to say.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate your call and all that you do, because you've been tirelessly working yourself. Thank you, my friend.
Okay.
All right. Moving along here, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about China and the situation there, and the situation, how it affects the whole global market. One thing that disturbs me in a big way is this move toward digital currency, because if you're not a slave now, once they move to the digital currency and they can zap your bank account at any point in time, that's going to be, that'll make you all the more a slave, basically being at their mercy. Every single transaction between private individuals can be tracked. And we predicted many years ago that cash would be villainized someday as terroristic. We're seeing different countries go toward digital currencies. Economic Policy Journal says China wants to issue its own. China's central bank plans to issue its own digital currency, quote, as soon as possible. And they cite Xinhua as the source. The People's Bank of China made the announcement at a conference on digital currency in Beijing. It's the PBOC's answer to Bitcoin. But get this, via the diplomat, it says China's eventual digital currency would be quite different from Bitcoin in that it will be tailor-made for the Chinese government to easily track transactions and will be under the aegis of China's central bank. In fact, the PBOC believes a digital currency will actually improve its ability to control China's currency. Bottom line, digital currency is going in a very bad direction. It's being implemented, listeners. That's the Economic Policy Journal. Moving along, we see from CNN, big banks brace for oil loans to implode. They say big banks are cringing as crude oil is crumbling. Firms on Wall Street helped bankroll America's energy boom, financing very expensive drilling projects that ended up flooding the world with oil. Now that the oil glut has caused prices to crash below $30 a barrel, turmoil is rippling through the energy industry and souring many of those loans. Dozens of oil companies have gone bankrupt, and the ones that haven't are feeling enough financial stress to slash spending and cut tens of thousands of jobs. Three of America's biggest banks warned last week that oil prices will continue to create headaches on Wall Street, especially if doomsday scenarios of $20 or even $10 oil play out. Oh, but don't worry, listeners. The big banks, they're all too big to fail. You've got deep pockets. You can bail them out. Or better yet, maybe they can bail in to your bank account like they did in Cyprus. Stealing your wealth, stealing your savings, stealing your money, what little you have left. They say Wells Fargo is sitting on more than $17 billion in loans to the oil and gas sector. The bank is setting aside $1.2 billion in reserves to cover losses because of the continued deterioration within the energy sector. J.P. Morgan Chase is setting aside an extra $124 million to cover potential losses in its oil and gas loans. It warned that figure could rise to $750 million if oil prices unexpectedly stay at their current $30 level for the next 18 months. The biggest area of stress is the oil and gas space, according to J.P. Morgan's chief financial officer, Marianne Lake. She says, as the outlook for oil has weakened, we would expect to see some additional reserve build in 2016. So we got that going on. Wouldn't be surprised to see the banks with their hand out again. And, of course, they're continuing to stick the American people more and more overdraft fees, as they always seem to do. And see, right now with cash, you don't have to deal with banks with cash. In a digital currency world, you would probably be forced to have an account. They say, ever taken cash out of an ATM and gotten shocked with a $3 fee or worse? You probably weren't thrilled about that. Nobody likes those fees except for banks. America's three biggest banks, J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo, earned more than $6 billion just from ATM and overdraft fees last year, according to an analysis by SNL Financial and CNN Money. Raping, pillaging, killing the American people financially. Now, Steve was just talking a moment ago, and we got into the fact that the show is being monitored. I want to say to you people who are monitoring the show at the federal level, you better really pay attention to what's happened with former FBI agent Robert Levinson.
Republicans on the campaign trail taking aim at the White House over that prisoner swap with Iran. And while the families of those freed Americans are celebrating with their loved ones, another family is feeling betrayed. ABC's Brian Ross is here with that. Good morning, Brian.
Well, good morning, Robin. That's right. The criticism is coming not only from Republican presidential candidates, but also from the family of the one American who was not part of the deal, the American left behind.
Under the deal, the U.S. released from prison seven men convicted of helping Iran's nuclear program and dropped charges against 14 more. Republicans are calling it a bad, one-sided deal.
Fact is that we shouldn't have to trade anything to get our citizens back home.
We've got to shake our head at how it's happening.
But no one was more upset with the Obama administration than the family of the American seen in this hostage video, who was not part of the deal.
Please help me.
Former FBI agent Bob Levinson, who disappeared in Iran almost 9 years ago. His family says it heard the news on television, not from the White House.
I'm very disappointed. I feel extremely betrayed by them. They have done nothing to get in touch with me other than after I asked them to.
Levinson's wife, Christine, and son, Dan, said the White House has gone back on its word.
We had been given assurances over the years that my dad would be a top priority to get him home as much as everybody else, if not more, because he's been held for almost 9 years.
So there you go, ladies and gentlemen, and there you go, FBI agents, NSA spooks, and people who work for the federal government. You better learn this. They eat their own. They don't keep their promises. They will stab you in the back when the time comes. So just be mindful of that when you think about the world you're helping to create. Moving along here, we see from You're Active, IMF recommends paying refugees below the minimum wage. As your nation is flooded with migrants, Obama's promise to bring more in refugees. International Monetary Fund has highlighted the positive effect, listeners, of public spending on refugees on European gross domestic product, but has also recommended that employers pay them less than the minimum wage. What's that going to be doing to domestic workers?
How are they going to fare when you got these discounted workers flooding your nation? Do you think they're going to hire you? Hardly. They say the International Monetary Fund produced a report on January 20th on the economic challenge posed by the influx of refugees into Europe. In this document, the organization recommends a short-term differentiation in the treatment of refugees and EU citizens, precipitated by the Syrian crisis, as well as conflicts in Afghanistan, Iraq. Now, the vast migration toward Europe is a cause of real concern on the continent, where attitudes towards the economic, social, and cultural integration of migrants took a worrying turn after the events in Cologne. Sexual assaults, molestations, gropings, listeners, and now below minimum wage levels of employment. This is a war on the people. This is a war on domestic people in countries, developed countries everywhere. This is why everybody needs to be aware of it, and everybody needs to get active. Hour number three of Govern America straight ahead. Things go as planned. We'll have Vicki Davis with us, and we'll talk about the Bureau of Land Management and their associated corruption. Stay with us. We'll be back. All right, we're back. This is Govern America. GovernAmerica.com is the website, www.governamerica.com. And we're on American Voice Radio Network. Please support the network as you're able, as they need your support. And this is hour number three of the program here, as it continues to be the 23rd of January, 2016. That's Steve Dore, by the way, D-O-R-E. His music is online. Lots of great music that he has. Does a fantastic job. Support the band, support the music, to support the movement, because freedom is the most important thing that we could ever have. And the people who help to support the freedom movement in song helps with morale and helps to convey a message that maybe the spoken word can't convey properly. Anyway, continuing, we have, I believe we have Vicki Davis on the line. Vicki, good morning, or good afternoon. Yes, it's morning.
Good morning.
Still morning where you are.
Well, yeah, good afternoon. Well, it's still morning. I hope you didn't hear my phone ring.
No.
I don't know why that happened. Every time I go on the radio, first thing that happens is my phone rings.
You need one of those automatic mute devices, or the relays.
Oh, that's a thought.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to work up, though. Anyway, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing fine.
You've been very busy lately.
Yeah, I was up until a few days ago, but you know, once I came home from Burns, it's kind of hard to keep up with what's going on up there.
Yeah.
You know, from this far away, so.
Yeah, my understanding is that they've been the Bundys, or Ammon Bundy, and some of the folks up there have been trying to talk to the FBI, because the FBI was calling him. And he went out to the airport where the FBI has set up shop, and he spoke to them. I thought about lifting some of the audio for the show, but the wind was blowing so bad out there, it's hard to hear. And that's the reason why I basically decided against it. But they weren't really saying much of anything, except Ammon was trying to talk to the FBI agent and educate him as to the Constitution, their constitutional role, and why they're there, why, you know, federal land is unconstitutional except for very specific purposes laid out in the Constitution. And anyway, they had a couple of attempts at trying to meet with the individual that Ammon was talking to on the phone, and so far that doesn't seem to be happening. And somebody pointed out that prior to Waco, and I don't want to be too dark about this, but they said that, you know, prior to Waco, of course, David Koresh was able to freely come and go. And the federal government, the federal agents, still decided to burn the building down. It wasn't a compound, folks. It was a church. It was their home. And This is what we want to prevent in this case. It's kind of bizarre, some of the way that, you know, they just have freedom to go wherever they want to go, and that's you know, a good thing. But you got to wonder what they have up their sleeve, because, and I'm talking about the feds, not Ammon, because he's been very open about what he wants to do. You got any thoughts on any of this, Vicki? You know, I don't want to ramble.
Yeah, I do, actually. I don't think that waving the Constitution in front of the FBI is really the right
strategy.
A thing that's going to work. I don't think that will work, even though they took an oath to uphold, you know, protect and defend the Constitution. The FBI, really, what they should be investigating is the Bureau of Land Management and their criminal activities that they're engaged in order to do something that's called land rationalization. I mean, there's actually documentation on their plan to consolidate and, quote, rationalize the federal land holdings. And what that means is that they are, and to manage all of the resources as an ecosystem, as a fully functioning ecosystem, which means the land, the water, the minerals, all of that sort of thing. And that is their strategic plan. And what that means is that they are consolidating their holdings in such a way to eliminate private land ownership that is embedded within the areas that they want to control as an ecosystem.
Yeah, I come back to this. You remember the document, or actually the article, that was in the, you know, I think it was Montana, if I remember correctly, where they were quoting the, you know, Assistant Secretary of Agriculture Rexford Tugwell, that, you know, in the future, government would control all land, and that, you know, controlling the total volume of farm products by limiting the area available for production, the government acquiring and devoting to other uses all land in excess of that needed for production. So we're seeing that materialize today right before our very eyes, aren't we?
Right. And a few years ago, when Michael Leavitt was the secretary of, I can't remember whether he was Secretary of Health and Human Services or a different agency, but under the Bush administration, he proposed a system, another computer system, called Farm to Table. What that computer system was is a supply chain management and tracking system to basically monitor and control all farm production in the country. You know, making farmers have a computer system and record in the computer system everything that they do, and the government would monitor and track everything. Well, you know, this really is a totalitarian system that
Absolutely.
They are implementing.
Absolutely.
And if you just only look at the Hammond case in isolation, then you could say, well, yeah, you know, maybe occupying the Malheur headquarters was a little over the top. But if you look at the situation in its entirety, and you make the effort to understand what's going on in this country in terms of this totalitarian system of control, what he did is just the bare minimum of what should be done.
Well, he says, and you said it yourself, and I think very accurately, so this really amounts to civil disobedience. And civil disobedience has really been a part of the American landscape for as long as this country has been around. And so, you know, even though we don't condone illegal activity and all that, The point is, when you consider the illegal activity that's being done by the federal government in using this refuge, and this is what Ammon says, is that the refuge has been used as the base, basically, to take control of people's ranches. It's ever expanded. It's like a cancer, Vicky. These things, these cells continue to grow and expand outward to the point where it swallows up more and more and more acreage. And at some point, it's got to stop.
Right. Well, and that is their plan, to do that. I mean, and it's documented. It is well documented. And the Malheur Refuge surrounds the Hammond Ranch.
Mm-hmm.
Just that fact alone, okay? The refuge surrounds the Hammond Ranch. The BLM has put other ranches out of business all around. Hammond would not sell his property, and he was charged with eco-terrorism for doing nothing more than what every rancher there and the BLM does themselves. Okay, if that doesn't tell the FBI and law enforcement and everybody else that there's something really wrong going on in the BLM, then I don't even have words to know what to say.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's as if criminality has been legalized as long as the government does it. And something else, too, that has really bothered me. The FBI has always been involved in white-collar crime because white-collar crime is by white-collar criminals, and that means that they are smart criminals. Who is engaged in keeping track of white-collar crime these days? If you've got the FBI out in full paramilitary SWAT uniforms, where are the cops with the brains going after the criminals with the brains? Do we have any anymore?
Well, presumably so, but, you know, certainly going after terrorist groups, terrorist organizations and terrorist individuals who are not really terrorists at all, but to justify a budget. And this is the problem, Vicky, that we have a third of the FBI's budget. I sound like a broken record. A third of the FBI's budget goes to counterterrorism. And with that,
well,
third,
you're right about that. The accountants and the lawyers really are the ones that are running our government.
Well, and the problem is that I think the war on terror has become the war on the mentally ill, the mentally handicapped, because they're pursuing people who are ordinarily they wouldn't have done anything, but yet the FBI zeroes in on these people and takes them by the hand and says, hey, you want to do this, you want to do that. And they say, oh, okay, I'll do that. And then when they do it, aha, you're a terrorist. Congratulations. They held a press conference and talk about how they thwarted another terrorist. Evil, big bad boogeyman. You know, it's a show.
Well, and that's you're right about the FBI having to justify their budget. And the only way they can justify their budget is by the numbers. It's not the quality of the crime that they bust, it is the quantity. And so, yeah, they go, you know, lead some mentally ill guy to do something stupid, which is not hard to do, just about anybody could do it.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean, you know, where are the white-collar crime fighters? We don't seem to have any anymore, because if we did, they would be looking at the government itself.
And then you got this situation with this Judge Grasty, who is operating in Harney County, Oregon. And you were talking a little bit yesterday, or the other day, when we were talking on the phone, about how this man has a significant conflict of interest. You want to elaborate on that?
Oh, yeah. His brother works for the BLM. And his brother's territory actually borders and actually runs into a little bit of Harney County. And so, you know, they've got kind of a sweetheart thing going on there. And then the director of the Malheur Refuge is married to the BLM director.
Now, see, I didn't know that part.
Oh, you didn't?
No, we hadn't got that far yet. Wow.
Oh, yeah. The director of the BLM district that the Hammond Ranch is in is married to the Malheur Refuge director.
Wow.
So, and I mean,
this is
so
an unbelievable
Grasty,
corruption.
And Grasty is doing absolutely everything he can to get this thing shut down because he does not want the light shining on him. It's too late. It's too late, you know. And the sheriff, no doubt, was appointed by the county commissioners, and I'm sure Sheriff Dave Ward is a very nice man, but he does not have the strength to be the sheriff of that county.
Well, I don't know that he's a nice man. I mean, I keep hearing that over and over.
I'm giving him the benefit
of
the doubt.
You know, my definition of nice is that you do your job and defend the people that need to be defended and not the criminals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't roll out the welcome mat to a federal agency that's up to no good and helping to protect the racket that's going on, the corruption that's going on in that county.
Well, you know what? After listening to those two hearings that I found, the hearings by Congress on the threats, intimidation, and abuse by federal land managers, makes it easier to understand why people are afraid of them. They seem to have no check on their power to break the law.
Mm-hmm.
in you know, fulfilling whatever their mandate is, what this mandate is, you know, which is to consolidate and rationalize the boundaries of the land that they've decided to take out of productive use.
You know, you mentioned the sheriff being involved in this, and I'm wondering what avenue for redress of grievances that exists here. I don't really see any, because you got the governor calling for basically, you know, the heads of these people who are occupying the Malheur Refuge. So she's on the wrong side of things. You've got the sheriff siding with the feds, and you got the feds there, so you certainly can't be calling for a federal investigation of the local officials when the feds are there to stifle any opposition to it. So where do you turn? What do you do? When you have basically the entire deck of the establishment government on the wrong side of things.
Right. That's right. And that's why I so admire and thank Ammon Bundy for what he did, and the people that are with him. I thank them for what they did, because they brought the public's attention to not just the Hammond family, but to the entire situation. And I've been writing as fast as I can and researching as fast as I can, but I, you know, I really wish other people would do it too, because we need to get this information out. I mean, I've known for quite a long time that we have a criminal government. When the Clinton administration redesigned our government,
mm-hmm.
it effectively was a coup d'etat from within.
Yeah, the term is reinvented.
Yeah,
which what authority do they have to reinvent government? You know, we have a situation here in Michigan. Rick Snyder, the governor of the state of Michigan. He ran on the platform of reinventing Michigan, and I recognized it as soon as he said it, because I knew that, you know, that's the term Clinton and Gore used when they were reinventing government. You know, we've talked, you and I and Nancy, and you know, we've talked about this on this broadcast ad nauseum, the reinvention of government, and here we have it again. You know, of course, we didn't know at the time that that meant poisoning people here in the state, but.
yeah, poisoning people and importing what are essentially soldiers,
Chinese spies,
barbarians from a different culture that are going to destroy our culture. destroy everything. And I don't know what it's going to take for people to understand that this is a war in a different context than soldiers and shooting bullets. But it is, in fact, a war on the people, on the American people.
Well,
and the thing is that all the people in law enforcement, they're all busy, you know, in their day-to-day things that they do, and they don't really have time to study this whole situation. I don't know that there is anybody that is really looking at the entire situation of our country. I don't even know if, you know, I don't know what the military, the Pentagon does. I don't know what the CIA is doing, except that I do know that all of the CIA middle managers were let go.
Well, that's interesting.
During the George Tenet administration, and they brought in a whole crew of young people. Okay, and so I don't know if anybody is actually doing any analysis from the high level perspective of what happened to our country.
Well, I think if there were any patriots in the federal government, they've probably been purged by now. We know that many of the military people have during this administration.
I know. The last thing I read was that an admiral was fired because he pointed out, he told people that Obama was buying a mansion in Dubai.
Yeah, interesting. So, well,
where did he get the money to buy a mansion in Dubai? He didn't have that kind of money.
Well, you know, he siphoned it off the American people, I'm sure. You know, and every single one of these, you know, and he's got his foundation, and I forget what he calls it. But every one of these presidents, and I put that word in quotes, they set themselves up to be have a very lucrative future after they leave office, you know, to the point of arranging things ahead of time, you know, and under the guise of, you know, charitable works, you know, promoting it while they're in office so that after they leave office they can have this nice cushy future. You mentioned the war on the American people. I don't know if you happened to hear earlier what we were talking about, how they're having these military exercises in Washington State now. They're having drills, and they're not telling people about it. This harkens really back to Jade Helm 15. Last year, when we had this massive multi-state exercise going on, the purposes of which... You know, a lot of people imagine the worst when they don't know, but all I had to do is listen to what the actual organizers were saying about it, enough to know that it was an intelligence gathering operation on the people. And that, you know, these things are more and more common, and we're not seeing when they go on. They're going unannounced. To my knowledge, this doesn't even have a name. Normally, these exercises have a name. If it has a name, they're not telling the people what the name is.
Yeah, well, the biggest concern is when is it going to go live, and will they actually be American soldiers? I don't even have confidence that the United States, that American military.
Say that again. You cut out for a moment.
I said I don't have confidence that Americans are in control of our own military.
No, I don't think
and
so.
And on this exercise, you know, my concern is, you know, when is it going to go live, and will they actually be American soldiers?
Well, presumably it already is live. You know, it was supposed to have started, I think, mid-January, second week of January. I think it was the 17th. So supposedly it's going on right now. And we know with Jade Helm, you know, the guy, the organizer, we played the audio on the show at the time, said that that he was asked point blank if international soldiers might be a part of this event. And he said, not at this time. So I think everybody should be concerned about that.
Not at this time.
Yeah, not right now or something like that. I don't know. I don't know exactly what the quote is, but that was what the ultimate ultimately, is what he said. So implying, of course, that in the future, this could very well be the fact, you know, the reality. So I think about State Department Publication 7277 and how our military is progressively being disarmed in favor of the international thing. You know, every country under 7277, you know, blueprint for the peace race, has to be basically taken over by the UN. You know,
right.
I mean,
and does anybody trust the UN? If there's any police, FBI out there, do you trust the UN?
Well,
you want
to
lay down your American arms in favor of an international force? Oh, God.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thought of what Henry Kissinger is quoted as saying, if you remember, he said, today, you know, the American people will be outraged if UN troops enter Los Angeles to restore order. Tomorrow, they will be grateful. It was some kind of conference.
That guy is delusional.
Well, he was pointing to a crisis. Now, which crisis can we pick here? Because we got the economic situation, which we talked a little bit about in the last hour. We're told ISIS is here. And who's ISIS? You know, you were mentioning the intelligence agencies. We've got that supposedly going on here. You know, they drive Toyota trucks, which have, you know, decals on them from plumbers in Texas. And supposedly they're in Syria. You know, which indicates to me that the video is not being shot in Syria. It's being shot somewhere around the border, the U.S. border. This is psychological operations, Vicki.
Well, I have to say that no matter how bad things get and no matter how corrupt our government gets, and no matter how angry I get at our government and our soldiers and our law enforcement, the minute that a foreign soldier hits our shores, I'm totally behind this corrupt government. And the foreign soldiers, the United Nations, they are the enemy. So there you go.
Well, the problem with that, of course, is that the corrupt government allows them to come in, and the corrupt government is in line. I know what you're saying, but the problem is we've met the enemy, and the enemy is us. And I'm not talking about you and me or the listeners out there, most of them. I'm talking about the people who have allowed this to happen, who've facilitated this. They're the ones that are engaging in the terrorist type of activity. We're already at the bottom of the hour. Let's go ahead and take the break. We'll be back in a moment. And folks, you're welcome to join the conversation if you want. 1-844-646-8376. That's toll-free, 1-844-6-GOVERN. We'll be back in a moment. This is Govern America.
Well, 1 and 1 is 2. 2 and 2 is 4. 28 squared is 784. I know a lot of meaningless facts that I'll never even use. But I'm not at the MESC office. I'm at job interviews. I got the postgraduate, overeducated, out of work blues.
All right, we're back. This is Govern America. GovernAmerica.com. www.governamerica.com. Visiting with Vicki Davis this hour. Channelingreality.com and thetechnocratictyranny.com are her websites. Thetechnocratictyranny.com, where she does her writings, her research, and all the information that you can get as she does her work. Vicki, so you've been pretty much working on this situation full time, and you've been out to the refuge now a number of times. Can you kind of fill us in about, oh, I don't know, the mood out there, what's kind of been going on? Is there anything that the people should really know about the details about what's been happening?
Well, when I was there, I've been there a couple times, and I never felt uncomfortable at all. You know, I'm pretty sensitive to people that any sense of danger at all, I have no problem, you know, getting the heck out of there. But I didn't pick up any feelings of being in danger around the people at the refuge.
Yeah.
I think they're all good people. Now, you know, some people would dispute that, but I don't have any personal knowledge of anybody not being a good person and doing what they're doing for the right reasons.
Yeah.
So I'm not gonna say anything about anybody.
Yeah,
but since I left, I wasn't fishing
for that either, by the way.
Pardon me?
I wasn't fishing for that either, by the way.
I know you weren't. I was just saying that, you know, because there are a lot of rumors on the internet about this person and that person, and
right,
you know, they're
well. A lot of
history.
That, to be fair, has been perpetrated by the establishment press, who really wants to make them all look bad, and you know, some of the things that certain individuals have done, you know, makes you kind of wonder, well, why? That doesn't seem like a very smart thing to do, but you know, calling attention to problems and things like that, and I'm talking in generalities, but you know, it is what it is, you know, and the point is that unless somebody is being seen provocateuring, in this case, trying to get people to do things that they shouldn't be doing, you know, and that's of course always something you have to keep an eye on, you know, but to be fair, they have asked certain people to leave, I guess, when they seem to be questionable, and that really impresses me, you know, that they're seeming mm-hmm. they're watching out for that, and if they spot it, they deal with it, and that's very important.
I don't think anybody wants anybody to get hurt.
Right.
I think that's true of both the police and the FBI and the people at Malheur. I don't think anybody is out looking for blood. But apparently, you know, when the FBI set up their trauma center and their brought in their own surgeons, you know, everybody got upset, and you know, alerts were sent out. And
well, the thing that really upset me, and I think upset even the community, was the resignation of this fire chief. Who had been serving since, I think, the 1980s, if I remember correctly. I think it was somewhere around 1984 he started off as the city fire official, city fire chief, and then he, for Burns, and then he later on went on to take on the responsibility of being fire chief for the entire county. And he resigned because he said he couldn't trust the local government anymore. He felt betrayed.
Yeah.
And because of the FBI, undercover FBI agents operating at the armory, which, for some nefarious purpose, which is still yet to be revealed, what were they doing there? Why were they milling around there? And why did they lie about, number one, being there in the first place, and number two, when they were exposed that they couldn't lie about being there, then they lied about their purpose for being there.
Right. Yeah, they were skulking around, pretending to be, outsiders, you know, part, I don't want to call them militia.
Right.
But,
that's what the media is calling.
You know, pretending to be protesters. And there were a number of things apparently that happened in town. Like, I'm not sure if it was the sheriff's wife's tires on her car got slashed. You know, a number of things, and somebody got stopped by or harassed by a vehicle that had a 3% sticker in the window. But the you know, 3% doesn't do that kind of stuff.
Right.
So it's pretty obvious, and what everybody knows except the mainstream media is that the FBI has brought in provocateurs, and they're trying to scare people.
Well, and, FBI or somebody is bringing in provocateurs, but it's certainly if the undercover FBI agents were operating around the armory for some nefarious purpose, we have to assume at this point that they're the ones doing the intimidation. And that's the thing, is that all of these stories of intimidation in the community, people need to realize that what would be the point? What would be the point? How would it serve the people at Malheur to have the public in fear? How would it serve to further their purpose in doing that if they were the ones doing it? It doesn't make
Excellent
any sense.
Point.
Doesn't make any sense.
Yes.
You want the public to be on your side, not against you. So, anyway, I don't know. You know, we don't know how long this is going to continue to play out. Could be some time. And
yeah, I don't know, but I'm going to the next article that I write is going to be about the BLM and their land management policies, the edicts. I'm positive that they are implementing the UN's biodiversity treaty.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because earlier we were talking about, you know, of course, you know, the World Economic Forum is wrapping up, I think, today. Lots of doom and gloom, Vicky. Lots of scary stuff coming out of the World Economic Forum. Major people, people who, you know, we've been screaming about, you know, the situation, the financial system cannot continue to go indefinitely the way it has been. You got massive amounts of debt that have been racked up over the years. We've got literally the currency itself is debt. But everything, everywhere we turn, we see instability. We see debt. We see, but now we're seeing people, billionaires, establishment people, coming out and saying they're sounding like we sounded 10 years ago. You know that that this, you know, we're cataclysmic year. Royal Bank of Scotland. You know, we played audio from George Soros earlier saying that basically they lost control. You know, audio from the World Economic Forum chairman himself. He says that they don't know what they're doing, and I'm paraphrasing, but he says they try something to see if it works. I mean, this doesn't really make, shouldn't make anybody feel good about where we're headed here. And so my point is, with all the debt everywhere, with the economic crisis that has been drummed up and engineered, manufactured, the only thing of value that I see that we have left in America is our land, is our property. Is that what's happening here? Is this is the liquidation of the assets of the American people, the only assets we have left?
Well, I think that's perhaps what they are trying to do. But in general, in you know, as far as the whole world economy goes, I've said this before, they are trying to change the basis of the economic system.
What do you mean?
It's just like Pat Woods has talked about, that, you know, the changing to a carbon-based energy basis. And I don't mean the petrodollar.
Right.
I mean something much more arbitrary than that. They're trying to move to a virtual basis where essentially they just make it up. And they've got all kinds of computer models that they're trying to control all of it. But when you start out something on a lie and you build on a system of lies, it can't possibly go right. It can't possibly go right because there is no truth to anything that you've done.
Right. Exactly.
And so, you know, it's like a big house of cards, and it is going to collapse.
Well, and then we have the surveillance state taking place. You know, our infrastructure here in the United States, we're told, is crumbling. We have all this digital stuff being pushed in a major way. I was following the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. They held a hearing this past week on new technologies in the automotive industry. There were some interesting things that came out of the meeting. There's this guy. In fact, I got some audio here. This gentleman named Mitch Bainwall. He represents what they call OEMs, which are original equipment manufacturers. He says in this clip that he represents the D3. I'm assuming that's the Detroit for 3. He's an abbreviation guy. He loves abbreviations. But anyway, he's talking about the role of technology to enhance safety and bring down traffic fatalities. And he completes his comments with an interesting concept.
I appreciate the chance to be here today on behalf of 12 OEMs, the D3 and 9 others from Europe and from Japan. Our guys and other OEMs are investing massively in R&D, $109 billion last year, and that is 16% of the global R&D spend. That's roughly 4 times our economic weight. So we're prospering right now with sales, and we're investing back into R&D, and that's paying real dividends. As I got up this morning, I looked at the weather, and I realized I had to travel in 20 miles and tried to figure out the best way to go. I turned on my nav, and I took a path that was different than any other I'd ever taken over the last 20 years of commuting from Fairfax. And so nav directed me to Washington in a fashion that was quicker, so I saved time, it was more productive, it was cleaner, and it was more fuel efficient. And that struck me as kind of a metaphor for today. Technology is bringing about a convergence of these social objectives. The slide titled Total 2014 Vehicle-Related Fatalities shows that we lost 33,000 Americans on the road in 2014, which is obviously an awful number that we're all working to drive down. But I think it's worthwhile to point out that 97% of those had nothing to do with the vehicle, it's human error. And that's why technology is so important. Technology can mitigate human error. So crash avoidance technologies, whether it's the advanced driver assist or whether it's a fully autonomous vehicle, have a profound, almost magical implication for the economy and for life. This last slide shows the fundamental dilemma that we've got. This shows a 25-year pattern. The blue line is year-over-year change in household income, fundamentally flat. The salmon, I guess that salmon colored line that rises, is the price of the auto, which in part is being driven up by compliance responsibilities. And the yellow line is interest rates, year-over-year change in interest rates. So in effect, what we've done is we have financed the ability to comply with more expensive vehicles based on compliance by lower interest rates and with longer terms. And as interest rates begin to rise, we've got to be mindful of this equation because it produces a challenge that may have jobs implications in terms of the manufacturer of vehicles, but also adoption implications in terms of turning over the fleet to vehicles that are much more efficient.
Now, what I think he's saying here with his charts, just to summarize, the average income is staying flat, while the cost of compliance with all these rules, regulations, government mandates, that's going up, even as interest rates are going up. Ultimately, we're on a collision course, no pun intended, because the consumers will not continue to be able to finance compliance. That's what we're doing. We are financing our compliance with government dictates. What do you think of that?
Well, we could do a whole program just on that one little segment there. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen? The average price of a car right now is about $20,000. People won't be able to buy cars. They'll have to lease the cars. That's the first thing.
Yeah.
And with the price of them being so high, they will have to live in an apartment, you know, probably in an urban area. It will completely change the lifestyle. And to what benefit? To what benefit, really? All of this technology in vehicles, the last best technology in vehicles was, I think, something to do with the brakes, the anti-skid brakes. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I don't really even like those.
No, I don't either.
I'd prefer to have the brakes that I can slowly pump,
right.
You know. But
well, you know, the problem is this is more the effort of trying to make your car smarter than you are. What it really does is keep people from learning how to drive properly, and it introduces a lot of confusion into the situation because now you got to think, okay, do I have anti-lock brakes or do I not have anti-lock brakes? And are my anti-lock brakes working properly? That it's going to pump so I don't have to, you know. back in the day, we used to just know that you got a pump.
If your car breaks down, are you going to have to take out a loan to get it fixed because of all this computerized equipment in there?
Well, yeah.
I think so.
Well, the software.
The last times I've taken my car in to get it fixed, it's cost me $500 each time.
Well, increasingly, the software is proprietary, too. So I've heard of stories, they talk about the manufacturers being able to sue if you go and try to monkey around with that because you don't have the right to mess around with their proprietary software. It's crazy.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
It's crazy.
You would not want to mess around with their software because, I mean, you just would not want to do that. So,
yeah, I just thought that was interesting. Financed compliance. I mean... Mm-hmm. You know, and another person that was at this hearing was a female by the name of Genevieve Cullen. I can't even pronounce her name, but she's with the Electric Drive Transportation Association. Now they're all about green technologies, and listening to her, you know, it becomes apparent that the degree to which this move toward green transportation is being driven. And I'm really not trying to use these puns. From the top down, you know, most people don't care about green energy. You know, the vast majority of people, they just want a car that's going to get them there. They want something dependable, something affordable, you know, and something that's not going to break down on them. But anyway, if there was a market for it, green energy would be profitable on its own. The only way it can even masquerade as a viable business model is because the government is offering these grants the companies to play along. Anyway, she talks about the utility companies implementing smart grid technologies to deal with increased demand, and service stations implementing charging capabilities for batteries, and of course, public-private partnerships, Vicky, a big part of this.
Innovation in electric drive extends beyond vehicles. Collaborations are occurring across the industry to drive down ecosystem costs and build out infrastructure. Utilities are creating new business models with smarter demand management mechanisms to serve this mobile load and maximize the benefit of energy storage to the grid and to their customers. Vehicle, battery, and energy companies are partnering to scale battery production and diversify energy storage options at the home and commercial scale. Use of new and post-automotive batteries for stationary storage gives energy consumers greater control of their energy choices, enhances grid stability and efficiency, and it supports the increased use of renewable and distributed energy. At the same time, vehicle charging facilities have also expanded greatly. There are reported 12,000 public charging stations in the United States with 30,000 charging outlets. These numbers do not include private residential and the fast-growing number of workplace charging options available. Just as quickly, business models are emerging to leverage hardware and software capabilities for diverse charging needs and locations. Vehicle and phone-based applications, as well as increased operability between charging facilities, are making it easier for drivers to evaluate charging options and increase their electric miles traveled. Hydrogen infrastructure is emerging along with mass market fuel cell electric vehicles. In California, nearly 70 stations are scheduled to open in the next few years. Public-private collaborations are moving forward to expand that number in California and other states. Electric drive transportation is also reinforcing the autonomy in vehicles. While the continuum of autonomous technologies being built into vehicles today is not exclusive to electric drive, summarize, I will say that we are making great strides, but we are still an emerging market, and we're pushing to deliver enhanced performance at reduced costs. Public-private partnerships throughout the value chain, from technology to infrastructure build-out, are critical to speeding those innovations.
Public-private partnerships, critical. See, here's the thing. The people don't want this stuff. There's no market demand for this. If it wasn't for the public-private partnerships and government grants, none of this stuff would go anywhere.
Right.
So this is a top-down.
The government has, well, we've been funding research and development on renewable energy since the 1970s, and they have never made any progress on it. They simply cannot, they have not been able to produce anything that is cheaper than gasoline, that is even viable. Mm-hmm. You know, other than the power sources that we have, which is hydro, nuclear, oil, and so forth, you know. And these people in California, Silicon Valley really is the technology driver mm-hmm. of the country, and also the North Carolina Research Triangle for automobiles. But these people live in a world of technology development. They live to develop technology. They don't care whether or not it is cost effective, or you know whether people want it. They are just driven to develop technology for the sake of technology. And with the government providing all of the funding, and these psychopathic radical environmentalists, which I don't believe are environmentalists, actually.
Yeah.
They have developed a partnership made in hell.
Yeah.
And they are just, you know, going full speed ahead, developing all of this technology that we cannot afford and that we don't want.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the point. We can't afford it, and that's where I thought it was important, his, you know, the guy's comment about finance, Mitch Bainwall, his comment about finance compliance, because when the cost of these regulations are going up and the American people's earnings are staying flat, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that at some point people will not be able to afford cars anymore except the most wealthy individual. And this fits perfectly into the whole Agenda 2030, Agenda 21 plan to take cars off the road. And they talk about traffic congestion and the problems associated with it, and how difficult it is, because some of these fuel efficiency schemes they have going on might cause people to want to drive more miles if it becomes more pleasurable or affordable to be in your car. How do we get people to stay off the road even though it's more affordable for them to be on the road? Oops, people actually have a mind of their own. The slaves are not cooperating with us.
Yeah.
It's really just sick. It's you know, these people are really mentally ill. One of the things
there is no rational, I mean, there's nothing rational about what they're doing.
No. Indeed. And there's something out in let's see, where is this? Oh, Colorado, called Road X. And this was just announced recently.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay.
Hang on.
All right, let me just go ahead and go to this. This is Road X, ladies and gentlemen.
Technology is being deployed at an astonishing speed. Today, we aren't just adding lanes. We're adding imagination to how we move. Creative vision, powered by the latest in high-tech developments, give people freedom, connection, and experience through travel. Welcome to an era where world-class, innovative thought leaders and partnerships are driving remarkable advances in safety and convenience on our roads. RoadX is Colorado's investment in the partnerships and strategies to make the next leap in transportation.
Okay, we're just out of time, unfortunately, but maybe we'll pick that up next week. But what it is basically they track the cars everywhere they go through the mobile towers, feeding information from car to car. Everything's connected, including the highway system. And this is the stuff we've been talking about that's coming down the pipe for years. Now it's here, Vicki. They're actually doing it.
Yeah, they are. And it's all part of the house of cards that's going to collapse. I mean, the tech industry has been making a fortune ever since Bill Clinton kicked off the, quote, reinvention of government. And what the reinvention of government was is a technocratic, totalitarian technocratic tyranny of the kind that has never before been possible in the history of the world. And what we should pray for, actually, is a collapse of the whole damn thing. Because if they were ever to succeed, life would not be worth living on this planet, because there would be no freedom whatsoever.
I agree. Well, thank you so much for what you're doing and for being with us. I really enjoyed this hour. We could easily do another hour.
And another one after that.
Pray for this republic. Do what you can to restore it. Go to Vicki's website, thetechnocratictyranny.com. It's linked up with ours. God bless you, folks. Keep your chin up and do what you can to restore this republic. And we'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Vicki.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.